Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer. I'm in the same square as my brother, if you're watching this on YouTube, because it's summertime, which means I am in Holland, Michigan, hanging out with him. We brought a special guest, Dr. Brueger. He was on our podcast almost a year ago.
It was perfectly a year ago, I think.
Because of the concerns around semaglutide and blindness back then, which we're going to talk about again today. But there was a new report out in JAMA looking at macular degeneration. And quite frankly, we are not eye doctors. I'd be able to look at and give you the definitions of macular degeneration, but in my opto rotations.
Oh, dear. Did you pass that?
Yeah. Actually, anyway, there's a whole story around that. But anyway, I wouldn't be able to describe pathophysiologically exactly what it is. I could tell you out of a textbook, but we brought on the expert to talk about it. Dr. Brueger, and if you remember him, he's the guy that convinced me almost to put two fingers into some random guy's rectum. If you want, go listen back to that podcast. Actually, we have another good story about him because he was my brother's roommate in residency at Portsmouth Naval Hospital.
We were interns together, roommates, had some good times.
So before we tell you that story, why don't we get into we'll get into what the study is. Can you tell us what macular degenerate age?
Well,
neovascular, all these different things,
because there's a couple different studies out.
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the spiel that I typically give my patients. It's pretty canned speech, but if I have a patient referred in for macular degeneration, I confirm it on my examination and imaging. I say, listen, you genetically have a predisposition to build up waste material underneath your retina. And that waste material builds up, and that waste material has a fancy name. It forms these little bumps called drusen, a German-rooted word. I think it means geode or potato. Because when you look inside the eye, you see these little yellow bumps. And that's what you see when you Google drusen and figure out what it actually looks like.
That's a step one term.
From med school. I remember that.
Yeah. So you have these drusen building up, and they usually in the beginning. So if you're in your 60s, there's just a bunch of bumps. They can cause a little distortion or blurriness in your vision. And then those bumps start to cause out trouble. And I usually equate it to, listen, if you don't take out your trash, it's going to start causing trouble. So those bumps can do two things. One, it can cause inflammation and kill off the photoreceptors of the retina. And that's what allows us to see light. So if those photoreceptors are being damaged, they can die and fall off, and then you can develop a bald spot in your retina, and we call that geographic atrophy. And those bald spots continue to spread and spread and spread, a lot like a brush fire. As they spread out, they can take over the macula, and the macula is just a very central portion of your vision, all right? Doesn't affect your peripheral vision, so you never go completely blind, if you will, but yeah, you can lose all of your central vision. Imagine someone holding up like a grapefruit in front of your eye. You can't see directly straight ahead, but you can see all the peripheral vision.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's progressive and it's relentless. And it's the number one cause of blindness after the age of 65. Ultimately, then, those little bumps underneath the retina can also damage the waterproof liner between the retina and the blood vessels underneath it. And when that happens, blood vessels can grow up into the retina, leak fluid, and be exudative, right? It's leaching out fluid. And the analogy I like to use is, imagine if you have a garden, you put that plastic liner down to keep weeds from growing through. After years and years and years of abuse, you get holes in that liner and weeds can grow through. And that's where you hear primarily people needing treatment for their macular degeneration, and they get shots in the eye. If you notice, I never say it's one or the other. It's a continuation. It's a spectrum. It's kind of like you have some stale bread and it either has some mold or it doesn't, but it's still stale bread, right? in macular degeneration, you have any, either you're growing vessels or you're not. And those vessels can really take vision away from you. And my final analogy I like to give is it's like a cross-country trip. We're going to start on the East Coast and we're going to try to go to California, and California's blindness. It's a drive. It's a long drive. It takes a long time to just lose vision. But wet macular degeneration, when you're growing vessels where they shouldn't, is like flying to California. All right, you're going to get there real fast. And that's why we initiate treatment so early, to try and make these blood vessels shrink up, go away, and stop leaking out fluid and blood.
So when they're driving, is it pretty much a straight shot, or is it like National Lampoon's Vacation?
It's a little bit like National Lampoon's Vacation. So you can, and you may be driving, get on the plane, and craziness is happening. And then we intervene and we put you right back down on the ground, but you've lost some territory. You've lost some time.
But what causes it in the first place?
Yeah, what are like the risk factors and all that stuff? So age, you said, right?
First, parents is so genetic. Genetics. Right. So it's just not, you know, you didn't eat enough broccoli and now you have it. So yes, it has to be age. I get a lot of referrals for people who have bumps under their retina and they say it's macular degeneration, but they're 40. So they don't. They have other genetic issues. Two is we kind of have a list of entities. One would be female. So increased risk in female, Scandinavian descent. So white female, older, light colored eyes. So the lighter the eyes, the higher the risk as well. And then we also look at external factors like smoking. Smoking can increase your risk of macular degeneration 400 fold. Oh, it's so incredible.
That's a good number to remember.
Yeah.
So what's the baseline risk? Like, I know obviously there's the genetic predisposition stuff, but what's the usual sort of percentages of people that get this stuff?
Well, I'd have to look that one up.
Okay. I mean,
you're in an ophthalmology, but you see it all the time. This is what you.
Yeah, it's my bread and butter. I'm seeing like 20 to 30 patients a day with macular degeneration. Yeah. Like this isn't odd, and everyone's on a spectrum. So I can say, I have like a 63-year-old, they come in with a couple drusen. Listen, after the age of 55, you're allowed to have a couple drusen because they're deposits, right? So if you're 85 with five little drusen, it's not macular degeneration. If you're 65 with a few drusen, we're going to watch you. And some of the things we can do right now is you can take vitamins for your eyes, the ARADS-2, that's age-related eye disease study. So the National Eye Institute looked at high antioxidant usage. This slows down age-related eye diseases. And one that popped up was macular degeneration. So they had ARADS and they were using it, but those individuals had a propensity who were smokers to get lung cancer because of the beta carotene in it. So they did the study again. That's where the two comes from. And they took the beta carotene out and it worked just as fine. So now we have vitamins, and these are over the counter. You can buy them at CVS, Walmart, Target. I see them at Costco. You know, Whole Foods, wherever you want to go, you can get these. And those have been shown to slow down macular degeneration as well. Now, of course, we also know lifestyle. Other factors are where you guys come in. So if you have metabolic syndrome, right? If you have diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, we know that will push you down. You're going faster down that cross-country trip with the drusen because you're having trouble clearing out waste material. Right? Your oxidative stress is higher. This is an oxidative stress issue.
Is there any relationship at all, and maybe whether it's physiologic or pathophysiologic or just statistically, with, say, retinopathy? Because we've talked about retinopathy and, you know, Ozempic, Wegovy stuff.
Completely different.
But also, you know, diabetes. I mean, isn't diabetic retinopathy the leading cause of blindness? I mean, that's what I tell my patients.
Yeah, it's different. It is the leading cause of blindness overall, right? Yeah. But once you get older, macular degeneration takes over.
Okay. But is there like any relationship at all, or even just a correlation, just because they're both increased risk in diabetes?
What can start to happen is you have diabetic retinopathy will also start growing blood vessels where they shouldn't, start leaking fluid because their retina is not getting the oxygen they want. And when that happens, you start getting kind of like this muddled entity where you're like, is it the macular degeneration or is it the diabetes? But guess what? I don't care how your house started on fire, I'm going to put water on it. Mm-hmm. So we treat those growing blood vessels, the leaking vessels, with the same medications, the same treatment. So it starts getting muddled because it's hard to separate, well, this was coming from your macular degeneration, or was this coming from your diabetes? They both will cause similar issues in the macula. The diabetic retinopathy individuals also have problems in the peripheral vision. So often if you see problems out there and in the macula, you say, oh, that's probably more diabetic. If it's just the macula and their sugars are controlled, their A1C 6 point whatever, then you're like, oh, this is probably your macular degeneration. And that's where it becomes a little bit trickier to sort it out. But fortunately for me, I treat them both the same.
So the prevalence, so it's around 10% of people over the age of 50 in developed countries, but in 50 to 59, like 0.2 to 2%, 60 to 69, 2 to 6%, 70 to 79, 8 to 15% of people,
and there you go. 80,
about 15 to 30% of people. Does that sound right?
Now, that sounds about right.
Okay, so what are the differences between, because the study we're going to talk about today in, that was in JAMA,
the first one
freaked everybody out, was neovascular.
And neovascular, that's just blood vessels growing. That's wet.
So that's wet.
Right. So you have to have AMD to get wet AMD. So, and that's the thing. Like they're like, oh, we have mold on the bread. It's like, good. So you have stale bread. And so that's where you look at that study and you're like, oh, they just pick like a distal, you know, diagnosis as opposed to, you know, do you have drusen? That's where there's an article from ophthalmology as well, where they actually delineate more because they know their audience is a bunch of nerds like me about eyeballs and saying like, well, these are the different types of macular degeneration that we're looking at.
And that's the other cohort study you're talking about that actually said right. Maybe there's a reduced risk, even though we're going to talk about the one that said increased right. risk, right? Because so that was
another right.
similar type thing. And what's confusing to us, I guess, is they use slightly different terminology. So like mm-hmm. you said, they, in the one that showed a 0.1 versus 0.2 increase, you know, risk, it was, they said neovascular.
And it's also only in those with diabetes type, I assume type two or could be type
generally,
one.
Well, generally it would be type two.
But yeah, so they only looked at those with diabetes in this.
And then the other one,
type two, with the one in JAMA. So the one in JAMA that we sent, that everybody's like, oh gosh, look at this. And of course, because it was in JAMA.
Right.
And neovascular age-related macular degeneration, taking a GLP-1 receptor.
Exposed to GLP-1 receptor. That's how these
and,
studies
and
are not
with,
that great.
And they say with diabetes, they don't differentiate, but likely type two. And then what they do is they compare that to people that have likely type 2 diabetes who were not exposed to a GLP-1 receptor agonist.
And that's where, you know, right off the bat, as an ophthalmologist, I go, great. Are you looking at the same risk factors? Like all their parents had macular degeneration. Right. So, or did they already come in with macular degeneration and then they developed neovascular or exudative? Those are two of the same.
Yeah. And the absolute numbers seem really small to me, like 0.1% for the unexposed to 0.2% for the exposed, which of course leads to the headline saying, oh my God, it doubled the risk, but the absolute risk. And again, this isn't the trial. This is a retrospective analysis.
Yeah.
So does that alarm you? I guess those numbers at all. Okay. No, good.
No, I'm not alarmed at all. And that's where you start poking holes in it as an ophthalmologist, because you're like, did they have the diagnosis of macular degeneration first? And then did they develop that second? And then you also have to look at your straight across risk of developing neovascular AMD or wet AMD. And ultimately, the longer you have AMD, the higher risk, because after so many years, you have now more stress, and eventually a vessel is likely to grow. So do I see a lot of 60-somethings with wet AMD? No. Do I see a lot of late 70s, early 80s with wet? Yeah, for sure. That's kind of my bread and butter. And that's just because you have these drusen wearing out that waterproof liner. It's called Brooks membrane between the retina and the blood vessels underneath it. So you would have to step back from some of that, because that's just like plowing through charts. And even if we look at another study, you have to say, well, how many people were diagnosed correctly? I have a lot of people refer to me with a diagnosis of macular degeneration. And I look and I go, it's not. You actually have choroidal folds. Oh, you actually have whatever. And that's coming from a retina specialist where I am trained to pick those things out. So even so, like the diagnosis that people click on there in your chart and assign to you, you just have a couple of drusen, you don't actually have macular degeneration, but they will click that or follow them as such. So you have to be careful with these retrospective studies and kind of take them with a grain of salt.
So we talked about retrospective studies in the last podcast because we were talking about menopausal hormonal therapy and how retrospective studies, you can have these what are called biases and confounders. And so what about in this one, because they were being put on a GLP-1 receptor agonist, could that mean they were at a higher risk? And so they put them on that because they had worsening type 2 diabetes. And they were like, oh, God, we got to jump in here. They tried to control for those types of things. But it's like, yeah, these are worse off patients. So they're putting them on these GLP-1 receptor agonists. Yeah, it just so happened that they're the ones that are going to develop this at a slightly higher, well, double the relative risk, but absolute risk.
Does that make sense? Yeah, their blood pressure is higher. I'm sure they have metabolic syndrome, right? Yeah. They're just not sitting over there with some higher sugars and they're all hanging out. Everything's fine. Like they have high cholesterol.
Okay.
Yeah, they have obesity. They have increased oxidative stress. And that's the one thing the retina does not want.
Okay, so explain the article that we sent that was actually in Ophthalmology that goes over the different types, because I was looking at that going, it actually did differentiate between the different types, and that was overall a decreased risk.
And they said a couple things in that article, and it was a good article. I mean, I'm biased because I'm an ophthalmologist, and it made it into our major journal, which is Ophthalmology, right? And there's even a subset of ophthalmology for ophthalmology retina. That's how big of a dorks we are. But to have that in there, they did break it down. And they were also looking at glaucoma. That's what POAG is, POAG, we call it, primary open-angle glaucoma. And that's what the ARADS 2 studies were looking at, was how can we try to slow down these age-related diseases. So this is nothing new from antioxidant pills that was developed over 20 years ago by the National Eye Institute. Now we just have something potentially more potent, right? And when you can reduce other risk factors, we can't change your parents. We don't have time machines. But if we can get you healthier, we can get you leaner, we can get your sugars under control, your cholesterol under control, and your blood pressure under control, we know you're going to do better. And I think that the ophthalmology article did a better job at least delineating from just macular degeneration to exudative macular degeneration. Because in our world, we say, great, which kind, right? And that is where they then pointed out it had a protection against. And there was some discussion about whether or not it was protective in other ways of like neuroprotection. Because remember, the retina is actually part of your brain, right? The nerve endings through the second cranial nerve, your optic nerve, are coming in, laying on top of the retina. They're making connections with photoreceptors. And that's right. I am a brain surgeon, all right? Because that tissue is there. And ultimately, if we can get some neuroprotection, then there may be some truth that it's not just reducing your risk factors. Maybe we're actually protecting some of those cells and decreasing the inflammation. And we know inflammation is the killer in macular degeneration. And we know it's also a problem with glaucoma. Case in point, dry macular degeneration. There are now shots available for geographic atrophy. Remember, I said those cells, those photoreceptors were getting pissed off, inflamed because there's waste sitting on them and they're dying off. And when we do imaging, we see those cells highlighted. They are angry, all right? It's called autofluorescence. And now we have complement inhibition that we can inject in the eye. And these complement inhibitors slow down that inflammatory pathway. And it has been proven now after 3 to 4 years of these trials, and they are available now commercially, is that it does slow down cell loss. So there's an inflammatory component. So if the GLP-1 can slow things down as well, cause less inflammation, I wouldn't be surprised if it was slowing down macular degeneration as well.
Okay, so the bottom line is that as an ophthalmologist, a retina specialist, you're not concerned with this, and potentially you think there's, based on the other data, there, if anything, there might be a benefit. Is that
That's right. The only time I have seen GLP once. Probably.
And I mean, we have meta-analyses of all the trials. Just the incidence, I think, must be so low. I mean, because they don't really note it. Obviously, we talked about retinopathy in the past because semaglutide, the Ozempic, Wegovy medicine, showed a signal of possibly increased risk of retinopathy. And you said that in your practice, you were very concerned about that.
But in diabetic retinopathy, right, that's right.
But in meta-analyses for all the different meds, I mean, there was a recent 2025 meta-analysis in diabetes care, kind of looking at all the trials in diabetes, mind you, so not obesity, but looking at all the long-acting GLP-1 receptor agonists. And it looked like it was kind of neutral, but obviously it said, well, maybe there's some differences amongst the individual agents, but on average it was neutral. But, you know, there's still that kind of that concern of semaglutide maybe having a specific issue, because one of them, an old one that we don't have anymore, albaglutide, which was not very powerful at weight loss or blood sugar control, but it did have cardiovascular outcome benefits, seemed to maybe be even protective, it said, for some of these, like in specifically late diabetic retinopathy. And this was in surgical ophthalmology in 2023. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. To me, it's like, eh, overall, it's like, eh.
Right. Nah. Okay. Like it's not going to move the needle too much, but we know from those studies, if you look at diabetic retinopathy, when they're in the clinical trials, they did notice a bump. I forget the percentage, but it's somewhere in the high teens. 17 sticks in my mind for whatever reason.
And it was really probably all from semaglutide as opposed to the other ones, interestingly. So, but on the other hand, I mean, like we said, diabetic retinopathy, I mean, all my patients are seeing you, not you specifically, but ophthalmologists, you know, every 1 or 2 years to get monitored for these things. And we know that glycemic control, blood sugar control, is one of the biggest factors in its own right. And then all the other risk factors that go with it, right? I mean,
sure, I got a lot of car analogies for some reason, but you know, diabetes for the eyeball is like a car. If your sugars are out of whack and you got an A1C of 12, that's like driving that car 200 miles an hour. You're going to run into trouble real fast. All right. You're going to blow a belt. You're going to overheat it. And these people come in, I look and I'm like, whoa, how high are your sugars? And they'll be like double digits, 11, 12, 13. I'll also see patients that have problems and I go, were your sugars out of control? Yes. About 10 years ago, I came in, I was in ketoacidosis. It was really bad. And ultimately then that's like you drove the car hard and now you're driving speed limit. You're like, I change the oil all the time. Like I drive the speed limit. I don't realize why I have trouble. And it's like, well, you were really hard on the vasculature of your eyeball. And now you're kind of paying the price. And we also know after 30 years, 95% of diabetics have some form of diabetic retinopathy. All right. It could be non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, super mild, but you do have it. And that's our classifications. And that's why we keep watching. And the first question I ask, how long have you had diabetes? Right. Not what your sugars are today. How long have you had it? What your sugars are today determines how closely I watch you. Oh, my A1C is 10. Oh, you're coming back in 2 to 3 months. My A1C is 6. I'll see you next year.
But do you also see, because we also talked about how in our world, we're often very cautious about those people who have an A1C of, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, whatever. Their blood sugars are always kind of in the 300s. And then they come to Jesus and bam, we get them fixed too quickly, whether it's all medication, lifestyle stuff. And then they go from an average sugar of 300 down to 120. And that exacerbates retinopathy and neuropathy, by the way. So
blurriness.
That's right.
Yeah. Osmotic.
That's right.
All the things, right?
It's not just the osmotic changes. It's also that you are now getting blood flow to your eyeball correctly. All right. So
it's temporary.
It's temporary. It does fluctuate. We have to watch them. Sometimes I have to give them shots to control them momentarily. But we also see this when I look in an eye and I see one eye rip-roaring diabetic retinopathy and the other one doesn't. Oh, I need to get a carotid ultrasound because the eye that looks healthy and normal actually is not getting blood flow.
Oh, wow.
And they usually have more occlusion of their neck on that side as opposed to the other side. So now as you start getting your pressure under control, you're getting your sugars under control, things go a little haywire in the eye. And I talk to my patients about that. I'm like, all right, your A1C is 12. Your sugars are in the 300s. As you're correcting, I'm going to watch you closely. And we will see that kind of fluctuation. Sometimes I can just ride it out. Sometimes I give them a shot or two just to kind of control things.
So for people worried about this, I mean, the thing is, this we're talking about severe cases of type 2 diabetes. This isn't likely any risk for the neovascular for people that don't have type 2 diabetes. Is that likely the case?
Yeah, your risk really inherently is, do you have underlying macular degeneration?
First,
but then I don't think you're going to, I think the take home is, I think you're not necessarily increasing your risk with these medications.
Yeah.
And I think the ophthalmology article nails it.
Talking about retina, I'm saying, but we keep going on and talk about type 2 diabetes because I think everybody's just really scared because there's a lot of people taking these medicines that don't have type 2 diabetes.
If you have retinopathy, then you're taking these medications, you may increase your retinopathy. And I see it. It's very specific. When I look in, I go, oh, are they on a GLP? And we have the list of all of them on the wall. So I can look at it quickly and look through their medications and be like, there it is. I know what's going on.
To add more things.
Okay. All right. Lastly, we talked last year about the NION stuff. I always have to look it up. Non-arteritic anterior ischemic optic.
NAION. That one, we say all the letters. NAION.
NAION. So not NION.
No, okay. It's NAION. And POAG is not POAG. It's POAG.
Okay.
That's the one in the article.
All right, we're going to quiz the audience later.
All right, so last year there was a suggestion of an increased risk of that with people taking semaglutide. Actually, the European Medicine Agency said looks like a risk 1 in 10,000 people taking it. But then a new study we just sent you said there's no. Doesn't seem to be a statistically significant.
And it was still a retrospective matched cohort, no association, but the cumulative incidence was less than 0.1%. So
the
numbers are just so small, it
this just again, doesn't matter. This again is in type 2 diabetes. Again,
And remind everyone, last year when you talked about it, you were talking about sleep apnea, obesity, sleep apnea, and all
blood
these things that
increase
the risk of that anyways, right?
That's right. When your pressure drops too low, usually overnight, sleep apnea, your blood pressure is lower anyway, you're horizontal, then you can get poor blood flow to the optic nerve. You wake up and usually half of one eye is gone. All right. Super scary. You wake up, people are like rubbing their eyes, drinking coffee, and they're like, what's going on? And it doesn't come back. And again, just to refresh your audience's memories here, if they are obese and they have high blood pressure and then they start losing their weight, their pressure comes down, but they're still on the same medications, then what is that going to do? It's like giving you a horse tranquilizer, but you're not the size of a horse anymore. All right. It's going to do some bad things. So if you're on 50 milligrams or whatever, and now you only need 10 based on your weight, but you're still taking 50 milligrams, what's that going to do? Yeah, it's going to drop your blood pressure out, and then you may get this NAION.
Yeah, I know my brother, I monitor that like a hawk, and that's
right.
It is concerning about some of these other online places. They just slip out the GLP-1s, and they're going, oh, go see your primary care doctor for the blood pressure stuff. Meanwhile, they can't get into their primary care doctor for 3 to 6 months. And then their blood pressure drops. They pass out, hit their head, whatever.
That's the thing. We want to use these medications to help people with their diet, exercise, their weight reduction. That's the root issue of all these other things, blood pressure, diabetes, most of the time. And then they fix them. So we have to de-escalate a lot of their medications oftentimes.
Yeah.
And that takes... Yeah. I mean, if you let it just go, some things are getting better, but then you're going to, have risk of others.
Imagine if you had bariatric surgery and they kept you on the same dose of insulin,
yeah.
You'd kill them.
Yeah.
You would kill them.
Yep. So for those listening, people just hear blindness. So there are three different things we talked about. There's the macular degeneration, there's the retinopathy, two different things. And then there's the NAION, which is also different. So like, it's confusing. That's why we get the eye specialist on here. Our buddy, Dr. Brueger.
Ahoy, y'all.
So here's the, if you listen this far, let's tell you the funny story. So he was my brother's roommate, and there was this, they lived in this terrible neighborhood in Portsmouth.
Shut your mouth. It was a great waterfront.
It was awesome.
Townhome.
Bungalow. Yeah.
We painted the walls green and we'd still catch hell.
There was a silver fox that was somewhere around that we got reports of, that there was a silver fox around, and Dr. Brueger left his, they were on a one story. They left his bedroom window open. And for some reason, my brother, I think his now wife's, had this.
Yeah, this little welcome dog statue.
It was a dog, but it was like a,
it looked like a real little dog.
It was like a golden retriever.
Yeah.
A little like that. Guy.
And we were laughing so hard. We put that in his windowsill and just facing his bedroom.
Yes.
And we just waited. We waited and waited and waited. And all of a sudden, Brueger goes in.
He comes home.
Into his room, finally walks in. He goes, ah! Because he thought it was
him running out.
He thought it was the silver fox. We're pretty sure.
I thought it was. Oh, yeah. I remember that one. And ultimately, like, you're coming home tired. You've been working 18 hours, whatever. You're a little delirious as it is. And then you pop in and there is a freaking dog face just staring you at your bed. And yeah, I jumped. I ran.
We were waiting so long for that to happen. We couldn't wait for you to see that. So
we had a good run.
It was awesome.
Anybody listening to this, obviously, I have so many people. It's all in my Facebook groups everywhere. I'm sure, you know, my brother's getting these questions. People worried about GLP-1 medicines and blindness. Make sure you share this podcast with them. Dr. Brueger does a good job, because we wouldn't be able to explain this stuff. No. I could get AI to kind of go through it, but we've never seen it under the little microscopes or whatever the hell he uses.
Yeah, I just
look
send
at
people to him, and we would have been sitting here like Beavis and Butthead going,
blindness, generation. What it says it does.
We learn about empathy.
So on people like that aren't medical, you know, you go through med school, and we learned it was a buzzword, Drusen.
Yeah.
Like, we knew it to get the test.
Okay, you got
to
get that test question right, but we don't really know what it is.
No.
Not until you
or
practice.
We don't talk about it for, you know.
Yeah.
So
not
you don't
until you practice medicine and look at it and see it and treat it. Do you really understand it? You could spout off some facts about it. So it's really good to get that.
And if you don't, you lose it. So a lot of
and ultimately, like retina specialists, we have a lot of training on that. But even our comprehensive ophthalmologists, you heard me say, they send me stuff. I do a lecture called It's Not Macular Degeneration, because there's so many things that it could be. And they tell these patients these diagnoses and they're scared. They're like, I'm going to go blind. I know what this means. They start Googling it and they come in. I go, number one, let's clear the air. You don't have macular degeneration. And they're like, what? And then I go through, I'm like, there's a lot of things that look like it, but it's not. It's going to be okay. It's just a couple bumps and so on and so forth. So it's even a black box sometimes in our world.
Very good. Well, share this with somebody who's worried. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.